Occult Collectibles is the number one site for historical items from the People's Temple, Heaven's Gate, Aum Shinrikyo, and many other cults that you never even knew existed. Hundreds of hours of work have gone into curating our collection of unique and one-of-a-kind items from the dark history of these groups. We also have a large selection of true crime memorabilia from such notorious cases as Edmund Kemper, Jeffrey Dahmer, Charles Manson, and many more. We add new items to the site every week and post sales and auctions on our Instagram at Cult Collectibles. Unforbidden Truth listeners can save 20% off their first order with the promo code TRUTH at checkout. So visit us on the web at cultcollectibles.org today.
Welcome to Unforbidden Truth. I'm Andrew. On this week's episode, I'll be speaking with Dr. Bill Kimberlin. Dr. Kimberlin is a mental health and substance abuse counselor. He wrote the book Watch Me Die, which is a first-hand account of Ohio's death row and the state's execution process. I speak to Dr. Kimberlin about executed Ohio inmate Frank Spezak and executed federal prisoner Lisa Montgomery and his book Watch Me Die. Here's my interview with Dr. Bill Kimberlin. Let's start off with having you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you do before we start.
Okay, so my name is Bill Kimberlin, and my background is quite a bit in the social sciences. So I have bachelor's degrees in criminal justice and sociology, master's in counseling, and my doctorate's in psychology. So right now I work quite a bit with inmates in the state of Florida as a counselor slash therapist. And over the past decade plus, I've been researching and writing about inmates on death row.
So you have a daytime job in an institution setting, and the like inmate stuff is basically just like a side venture?
Yes. So definitely not a hobby. So I've been in the field of academia for 12 years plus as well. And so when I started teaching at the college level, a lot of the questions that I would get in the different courses of psychology, like social psychology and abnormal psychology, were always the hot, debatable topics. Legalization of drugs, gun laws, abortion rights, and then, of course, capital punishment. So I've been fortunate enough to travel around a lot of different countries. So I knew a lot about the different drug laws growing up all my life in a family of hunting. Knew a lot about the gun laws, counseled a number of females with abortions and been to abortion clinics. But I did not know a whole lot about capital punishment, even though I'd been in the criminal justice system most of my life with probation and counseling and things like that. So I decided to look into that and see about going to death row and maybe witnessing an execution, not realizing how difficult it was, and found some loopholes. And next thing you know, I went down that rabbit hole and I've never come out since.
When you say you've gone to different countries, did you go to like visit prisoners? Like, did you have anything to do with the capital punishment there, whether it's watching executions or anything of the sort?
No. So with the industrialized nations, there's only two, Japan and the United States, that have the death penalty. So no countries in Europe, no other countries in North America like Canada, Mexico, none of those other countries have the death penalty, only the United States and Japan as far as industrialized nations. So I went over, I've been through different countries, you know, vacationing, and we go to Europe every year, aside from this COVID stuff. And their drug laws and things like that have been different over there, as well as their criminal justice system. So I've been able to study the different aspects of cultures in different countries. But when it comes to capital punishment, only here in the United States.
Let's talk about two inmates that were executed that you had personal relationships with. Let's start with Lisa Montgomery. Give me a rundown on who she was, starting from birth. From what I know, that she had a pretty terrible childhood, if not one of the worst, to commit capital murder.
So Lisa Montgomery had reached out to me many years ago. She was the only female federal death row inmate in the country. She was housed in Texas. She was a wife and a mother, had kids from a marriage, had a very abusive relationship growing up with a lot of sexual trauma, physical trauma, emotional trauma. She decided to one day, and I'm assuming this did not happen overnight. It was very well premeditated. Scope out a certain individual who was pregnant and close to delivery. She was selling puppies. She was a dog breeder as well. And Lisa had scheduled an appointment to go see a puppy, unbeknownst to the seller, that she was really there to murder her and cut the unborn child out of her and kidnap that child. She did so, and the child lived. She carried it across state lines, which made that a federal offense, which put her on federal death row. And they executed her in January of this year. First female federal inmate in close to 70 years.
What was she like when you would speak to her? Would she ever speak about her crimes and the abuse that she did suffer growing up? Did she ever open up to you entirely?
Well, I can't really say entirely because a lot of times, they tend to be manipulative. They also tend to keep some things to themselves. Lisa and I discussed a lot about her past. She never really used that as an excuse. She used more of her medical conditions. She had issues with her heart and things like that, from what she told me, as to why she really didn't feel the need to be executed. Yeah, I mean, she was always upbeat up until the end. She remained pretty positive. She was very much gloating on her kids and grandkids. She was, in all intents purposes, to an average individual, seemed very oriented, coherent, knew right from wrong, did not display any overtly mental health issues to me. But that was with my dealings. I by no means assessed her, nor am I a psychiatrist or a psychologist practicing or anything like that. So, I can only tell you how she was with me. And she was very, very alert, very oriented, very talkative, and was really up to date on everything. So she knew what was going on.
Did she mention if she was afraid to die or not?
She didn't say that she was afraid to die. She just didn't want to die.
Were you there present during her execution?
Hers, I was not. I was supposed to be, but the federal government, with the COVID restrictions going on, that kept me from attending her execution.
Would you have gone if there was no restrictions then?
Oh yeah, I mean, it was already scheduled. If she were to be executed, that I would be there. That took place in Terre Haute, Indiana, where all federal executions take place. So yeah, I mean, I had every intentions of going to it, but like I said, with the restrictions that were put in place, that wasn't possible.
Do you know what the procedures are for a federal execution, like the day of or days prior? I'm somewhat familiar with state executions after interviewing an inmate in Idaho, but I'm curious at the protocols with federal prison.
That's a great question because I've been doing this for, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 years, and I can tell you the protocols inside and out for state executions. The federal government is not as transparent. It's hard enough for the states and having to dig into the protocols there and be a part of that, but When it comes to the federal level, they're their own entity. So I can't even answer what the protocol was the day of, the day after, or the day before, because they just do not release that to anyone, myself included.
What about the protocol for a state execution? I know you've attended quite a few.
So state executions are a little bit different, I'm assuming anyways, because of what is allowed. I think I have six more scheduled to attend in different states, including the electric chair and things like that. So, but the ones that I have attended, is for Ohio, for instance. I had last meals with one of them. They are transported usually 36 hours ahead of time from their death row facility, which is in Chillicothe, Ohio, down to what we call Lucasville, the death chamber. They're housed in the death cell where they're under guard 24 hours with three guards in front of them at all times. Kind of like a Hannibal Lecter looking cage. Everything is open, so every single thing they do, from brush their teeth to using the restroom, is dictated and transcribed. They're allowed visits with their clergy, their family, if they so desire, or whomever is on their list. For me, I would go to the prison by for the day of the execution by 5:36 in the morning to try to get there before the protesters get processed in. I would see the individual typically all the way up until about an hour before their execution. Then I am, led over into the death chamber with two other individuals that would be on the defendant's side of the execution witnesses. There's three others on the prosecution side, so a total of six. And then you're placed in front of this glass window where everything is visible, and you watch them from start to finish, including staying there until the body is removed by the hearse.
Do you know about how many executions you have attended?
From start to finish, three. I had two stays, which meant that I was there, and then at the last minute, they were given a stay. I think I have four more scheduled for Ohio, one in Florida, and another one in California.
When was the California one?
No, that's still being scheduled because
Oh,
it's,
okay. I
yeah.
was thinking it was years ago because I was going
No,
to say.
California. Yeah, California, they tend to keep their people on death row for quite some time. In fact, the current governor right now, Governor Newsom, has a moratorium placed on them. So as long as he is the governor, there will be no executions. Now, that can change literally overnight based on the recall election that's going on, because whomever, if by chance he was recalled and another governor put in office, they could very easily lift that moratorium.
Right. And I know that they've been moving guys out of San Quentin to other prisons as well, because there's about 20 guys or so that I've heard of that have been moved already, to like Corcoran and other.
Yes. Yeah, I have a couple that have been moved already. There's been a bunch of my guys that thought they would be moved out, but nothing has transpired. They're still there. Even guys that aren't, there's still people on death row that the death penalty has been taken off the table, so.
There's quite a few people that have had their sentences commuted lately. I know Steve Crittenden is one, and I know Scott Peterson's in court if he already hasn't gone to court. I haven't really been keeping up with that.
Yes. So, as you well know, Scott and I talk. He just sent me another huge painting this week, and I actually just opened a letter of his today. So he's still there, on death row in the same cell, same pod, even though there's no chance of him getting the death penalty now because the state has removed that. He's waiting on another trial to either be, exonerated completely, or, if they find him guilty, then they find him guilty. But the state has already removed the death penalty from his sentence, so he is, by all intents and purposes, life without, but he's still on death row.
And he still maintains his innocence, right?
Correct.
Let's talk about another executed inmate that you had a personal relationship. That inmate being Frank
Spisak.
Spisak.
Frank was interesting. He wanted to be the next Adolf Hitler, I guess. He wanted to be the head of the ABs, or the Aryan Brotherhood, believed in only white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, hated anybody else, whether they were Hispanic, Asian, gay, you name it. It was white Anglo-Saxon Protestant only. And he went into Cleveland State University, killed a number of people, went to trial. His stature was about the same height as Adolf Hitler. He even had the same mustache as Adolf Hitler. So he was very, very, very defiant all the way through. Fast forward to when his execution took place, because at the time he was one of the longest ones on death row to be executed at close to 30 years. He had transformed himself from Frank Spisak to Francis Anne, petitioned the state of Ohio to allow him to undergo gender reassignment surgery, which they denied. He went from hating African Americans or anybody else that wasn't white to having a African American minister, and was admittedly gay. So it was a huge transformation from the day he went to trial to the day he was executed.
What was he like when you would visit him and, speak with him and talk to him on the phone? What kind of person was he like? Did you talk to him before he changed his ways, or was it after?
So yeah, he had already changed, his persona to Francis Anne when he had reached out to me, because it was getting close to his execution. And I'll be honest with you, I never heard of the man. He reached out to me through other inmates and asked me to be there for his execution. And this was before I ever even met him. So yeah, he was quite different, but he was very, very polite, very well-mannered, soft-spoken. He did not look intimidating whatsoever. He was just a very down-to-earth individual to talk to. That being said, that also shows you how manipulative these individuals can be on death row, because this was rather new in my career, so to speak, of researching. And I sat there and thinking to myself, this guy seems harmless and remorseful. I spoke to him literally, a half an hour before he was executed, and he was just so down to earth and so grateful that I would make the long journey up there to witness him being executed. He gave me all of the pictures with him and his daughter, who he had not seen since she was born, and just very, very remorseful. And then when, the guards tapped me on the shoulder and said it was time to go, I, went over to the other side on in the death chamber, and he came in and they strapped him down, inserted the needles, and of course they're allowed to make a last statement. And right away he started speaking in German, which infuriated the other three witnesses to the point where they wanted to do the execution. And I just, that blindsided me. I did not see that coming, because I thought he was genuinely remorseful, and he really wasn't, not at all.
So he had this facade going on in prison up until his execution, and then he just let out his true self?
Yeah, I mean, it really stunned me to hear him, you know, recite his last statement in German, which brought back, you know, right from the very beginning what he stood for. All the while being in prison, he wanted to be, you know, Francis Ann. You know, he wanted to have, and in fact did have sex with guys on death row, and, you know, had an African-American minister. I mean, I think he tried to fool everybody, but at the very end, his true colors were shining brightly.
So when something, I guess, negative happens at an execution, for instance, say like the victim's families, you know, gets upset, how do they handle that while, you know, either before or while somebody's being executed, if they're, you know, say like uncontrollably, you know, emotional, will they make them leave, or do they just let them, you know, handle their emotions and just proceed with the execution?
So they proceed with the execution. They do not ask them or tell. Strike that. I should say, I never witnessed or heard them ask them to be quiet or to sit down or anything. So when you go into the execution, the death house, there are literally three little seats sitting in front of the glass window. There's a partition, kind of like what you would see in an office, and then three seats on the other side. You never come in contact, and you never see the other witnesses, by design, of course. So they're led into the death chamber first, and then the three of us, whether it's myself, a defense attorney, and clergy, are led in second. And then standing up behind us would be certain members of the media or the press, and they're there to take notes basically of your reaction to the execution. So it's so quiet you could literally hear a pin drop, because, you know, you're literally watching a human life being taken in front of you. So then when the execution is complete, you know, they'll close the curtain. The two people you never get to see would be the medical physician who pronounces that person dead and the executioner. So they'll close the curtain. The physician will come out, pronounce them dead, go behind the wall. The curtain opens back up and they'll mark the time of death. And then the three witnesses on the defense side would exit first, with the three state witnesses exiting afterwards. So we never come in contact with one another.
Is the feeling the same each time after each execution, or does it differ?
You know, it's a very surreal feeling. And I hear it, you know, over and over and over again from so many people, friends, family, you know, strangers, that they would love to witness execution. They could, you know, pull the switch or, you know, the trigger or whatever. And I don't think they realize that when you're sitting there watching another human being die in front of you, someone who you had just spoken to moments before, not in a hospice situation, not in a situation where they were suffering or in pain. We were laughing and joking sometimes, also understanding that this person, no matter how vile they are, never did a thing to me or my family. I'm just there to study them. So there is no connection other than as a research subject, basically. And next thing you know, you're behind a piece of glass and you're watching needles being inserted into their arms or their neck or whatever, you know, route of administration they decide upon. And the life is taken out in, you know, right in front of you. So it's a very surreal feeling. I can't say they're all the same, but they're not all different either. It's a very weird, just kind of like an out-of-body experience when you watch a human life being taken in front of you.
Have you come across any cases, whether in the past or currently, where somebody you think might be innocent or you might know that is innocent that might be coming up, you know, with an execution date or nearing it in the future?
No. So for me, when I first started this, every single inmate had to admit that they were guilty before I would talk to them, because I was there to learn from them. I wasn't there to assist them, or certainly wasn't there to help them, you know, in their defense. If they felt that they were innocent, then by all means, they needed to seek out the proper legal advice and go down that avenue. But the moment they said they didn't do it, then I would no longer communicate with them. And they knew that. So every execution I've attended, they had readily admitted their guilt. I guess the only one that that would stand out right now that says, you know, maintains his innocence would be, you know, Scott Peterson. But for the most part, everybody that I've dealt with over the years, and it's been more than I have ever, you know, even counted, are, I would say, guilty beyond the reasonable doubt. There is one person in the state of Florida, Tommy Ziegler, I believe it is, that I've spoken to a number of times, who I think he's been on death row the longest, maybe 40, 42 years, that most people would think and agree that he would be an innocent individual on death row. Even the guards, the few that I have spoken to, because I try not to, will even say that. But that's probably the only one that I would say.
Let's say hypothetically that Scott Peterson remains on death row and he does get an execution date, and he asks you to witness his execution. Would you go to it knowing that he does proclaim innocence until the, you know, to the grave?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm a big believer in the judicial system. And when the jury speaks, that, you know, it is what it is. They don't always get it right. But, you know, we're in, you know, 2021 now. And I would think that if there's evidence that shows an individual is innocent, whether it's DNA or whatever, I'm a firm believer that all of that should be tested. I think every avenue should be, you know, exhausted before they issue that ultimate form of punishment, if in fact they ever do. I'm not saying that I'm for or against the death penalty, but you know, I from the people that I've dealt with so far, I think the system has gotten it right. As far as guilt or innocence, I'm not saying they got it right on executing or not executing, but as far as guilt or innocence, the individuals that I work with closely, I think are, for the most part, guilty of the crimes they've been charged with, and then some.
Throughout all your years of research, what do you think would be the number one thing that you've learned and you can take away from everything that you've, you know, done over your entire life, for that matter?
I would say that I am no closer to finding the answers now than when I first started, other than the fact that if I had to summarize all of these, you know, serial killer, mass murderers, individuals on death row, would be that they are pretty much all dangerously normal, in the sense that they could be your coworker, your next door neighbor, your friend, and you would never know it. They don't walk around with serial killer or mass murderer tattooed on their forehead. I don't think there's any certain way to profile a certain individual, you know, to prevent something. You can always look back and say, oh yeah, they fit this description or this profile. But as far as, you know, beating them to the punch and getting to them ahead of time, I just don't see that. These guys and females are very, very crafty and manipulative, and they, for the most part, enjoy what they do.
So you published a book called Watch Me Die. Tell me a little bit about that. How'd you come up with the concept of the book? And, you know, give me a little description of what it's about and, you know, how long it took, the research that went into it, so on and so forth.
So the book Watch Me Die, which is actually being republished and revised and republished, and it'll be out in the next month or two from Wild Blue Press, originally was just thrown together because of teaching at the college level. They like you to publish, and I had been researching for a number of years, not realizing that there was a huge following of people out there that really got into, you know, serial killers and death row and capital punishment. I was not one of those individuals that watched all the Dexters and the Mindhunters and all of that. So I was shocked to find out that there were that many individuals all over the world, especially in Europe, and that were fascinated by this genre. So I just threw the book together rather quickly, and it was all based on Ohio's death row at the time, with my experiences on the process of getting into death row, going on to death row, witnessing the executions, the whole process behind it. So that's what led me to doing the book. The title Watch Me Die was kind of catchy. I came up with it because the inmates literally would write me letters and say, "Hey, you know, Kimberlin, you want to watch me die?" I'm like, "Okay." So that's where that came from. And so the revised edition, while I'm working on a separate book, is kind of like Where Are They Now? For the ones that were talked about in death row, or the first one on death row, and the executions coming up that I'll be attending and witnessing. It's just, it's one of those things that just took off, and I had no idea that it would.
Are you working on anything else besides the, you know, republishing that? Are you working on any books following the Watch Me Die?
Yes, so I'm currently in the process of working on another one called Dinner with the Devil, which is six of the worst that I've actually sat down with and eaten dinner with and interviewed, you know, firsthand, person to person. There's also some rumblings in the background of looking at documentaries or a series based on, you know, my experiences on death row over the years, being considered an expert on death row, whatever that means, as well as the art that all of these guys send me, confessions, letters, maps, things of that nature. So there's a lot of projects going on in the background. But you know as well as I do that it takes a lot of time and patience.
Is there anything that you'd like to add before we conclude this interview?
You know, not really. I mean, I'm still, I think, in awe of the fact that so many people out there follow death row and the mass murder serial killers that they do, and not taking anything away from them. It's just difficult for me to understand what the fascination is, and it's probably because I've become so desensitized to it, which is not a good thing either. That, you know, I literally have Jesus, you know, thousands of letters and art pieces of art just laying around all over the place from sometimes inmates I've never heard of before. They just get my name from other inmates on death row. And I just wonder why, or how. But it's never a dull moment when I go on death row. It's fascinating. I'm still learning every day. And I don't think that there'll ever be a day that I can say, okay, I can stop because I know it all. When I stop, it's because I'm done and I close that chapter up in my life and I move on. But I'm still working on a lot of the answers myself.
That was my interview with Dr. Bill Kimberlin. Thank you for listening.
Unforbidden.